Good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming today. So this morning, I'm thrilled to have with me a colleague from Syracuse University. Dr. Bragan Riley is an assistant professor of marketing affiliated with psychology at the Whitman School of Management. She received her Bachelor's of Science degree from MIT and her doctorate from Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University. She held previous teaching position at Illinois Institute of Technology, and at Whitman, she teaches consumer behavior and intro to marketing. In 2015, Bragan was honored as SU and SUNY ESF's New Students Convocation Speaker, where she encouraged students to strive for excellence and take advantage of opportunities offered during their tenure in college. Dr. Riley's research examines how consumer behavior is influenced by beliefs about whether the economic system works. It focuses on how perceptions of access to economic opportunities and income redistribution guide consumers' pursuits of money, as well as spending and saving behaviors. Her work appears in various marketing and consumer behavior journals and has been discussed at MIT's Sloan Experts and the Financial Times. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Bragan Riley.
Good morning. Thank you. Thank you, Eileen. And thank you to everyone for getting up so early and coming out to listen to me speak. So my talk this morning is about understanding consumer behavior when the system does or does not work for you. And this is really the research that I am most passionate about. And I think it has a lot of implications for the changes that we're seeing in our economy going forward, at least for the next 20 to 50 years. So before I jump into the research itself, I want to give you a little bit of background about me. I think of myself as having grown up under cancer, and a part of this upbringing really shaped my passion and my curiosity for people's belief in economic systems. So as a child, I grew up in Atlanta, Georgia, and I was an anomaly because my mom was diagnosed with cancer when I was 8 years old, and I'm the youngest child, and I'm her only daughter. And so what that meant was that she felt a real sense of urgency about preparing me for life, because she really didn't believe that she would be around for the majority of my life, right? And so she spent a lot of time helping me build a really strong foundation, looking for opportunities that I could take advantage of, and really doing the best that she could to ensure that I had a bright economic future. What that really looked like, in a spirit of full disclosure, was a lot of summer school and a lot of Saturday school. extra projects, learning how to balance a checkbook and how stocks work at 12. It was a very different childhood, especially compared to the majority of my schoolmates. You know, they were playing sports and going to dances, and I was reading Rich Dad, Poor Dad. but my mom really encouraged me to look things up, to ask for help when I need it, to investigate things deeply until I felt like I had a strong sense of understanding, to try often and be comfortable with failure, because that's really how you learn. And so all of this led me to practice resiliency on a consistent basis. But as a child and as a teenager and even in college, what I began to see over and over again is that some people were definitely raised to have this sort of hypervigilance about their own outcomes, and other people weren't. And so it got me to thinking very deeply about the idea that there seems to be a difference between people who think the system is designed to work for them and people who don't, right? My mother definitely put forth the idea that I needed to take care of myself, that I couldn't depend on the education system or the university system on their own to take care of me. And so I needed to prepare and think deeply and figure things out on my own. But not everybody was raised like that. And in fact, a lot of people weren't. They were raised to, you know, have a lot of fun and enjoy life, and that things would work out eventually in the end. And so what I noticed about these two different sets of people is that they navigated spaces very differently. They looked at the world differently. And so that led me to my second sort of hypothesis, which I started looking at in undergrad. And that is, you know, how do thoughts about the system, whatever that system is, impact people's economic behavior? And so the real sort of thrust of my research, the real thing that I'm interested in, is how these beliefs about how the system works or not impact our everyday economic life. So in order to do that, in order to really understand how these beliefs impact our economic lives, I essentially develop and test theories about economic and social consequences of people's beliefs about the system. So here's the basic framework for every paper that I work on. I start with the assumption that there is a system, and I acknowledge that system, and I try to figure out what its rules are. And these rules typically take the form that an outcome or a set of outcomes, and these are economic and social outcomes, are a function of good actions and bad actions. So I'll give you a really straightforward example. If you study for an exam, you are more likely to get a good grade. If you get a good grade, you get a good GPA. If you get a good GPA, you go to college. Okay, so that's an economic system. It's an education system, but it does have economic and social consequences. And so that's the sort of basic framework behind everything that I do. Once I've identified the system, I figure out which people have different thoughts about whether that system works or not. So for example, are there things that people experience or that they observe that might undermine those beliefs in the system or that might reinforce those beliefs in the system? So for example, if you are at a school where all the teachers use the full grading scale, and so you get a 50% on an exam and you get a 50 written on your paper, that's meaningful. That tends to support the system. But if there's a really strong curve in every class that you take, that tends to undermine the system, because at that point, you don't really know what a B means. Does it mean that you understand 85% of the material, or does it mean that you just sort of ended up at 50% in the distribution, right? So those kinds of policies and practices can undermine or reinforce systems depending on what your initial beliefs about the system were. And the last thing I do, and this is sort of the interesting part, these are the results, right? I provide evidence of certain meaningful differences in attitudes and behaviors. And for the purposes of my work, these are economic attitudes and behaviors. So they pretty much deal with money, shopping, spending, stealing, saving in general. So all kinds of economic behaviors. So I'll give you a couple examples of other systems just to make sure we're all on the same page. Hiring systems typically are predicated on the belief that being qualified is important. But there's a lot of data that undermines these kinds of systems. For example, there's some research coming out of UCLA and a few other universities that shows that African-American sounding names receive 50% fewer callbacks for interviews given the same resume. This is research where they basically put resumes together and changed only the name. And they found that with the exact same credentials, people who have names that sort of mark them as African American just receive fewer callbacks. And 50% is a big deal, especially when you're looking for a job, right? There's more recent research that suggests that even headhunters work less aggressively for their clients of color. And so what you might expect and might have found to be true in your own observations is that people of color tend to have less faith in hiring systems. They tend to, you know, sort of be hypervigilant. They expect the worst, those kinds of things. Another kind of system that we can talk about, or that, you know, we definitely do talk about in the news and popular press, are economic systems more generally. We have this belief that people who work hard and are loyal to the firm should be rewarded with higher wages and with other promises that firms made to them in the past. And this is probably going to resonate for a lot of people who've been in Syracuse for the past 4 to 6 decades. when jobs are relocated to other regions because the wages in those regions are lower, what you find is a bunch of people being laid off due to no fault of their own. So they were great employees. They came to work on time. They did the job well. They really cared for the company. And now they're left out in the cold. We also see this happening with the influence of technology. So in a lot of industries, labor is being replaced with automation. This is not because people couldn't do the job well. It's because machines are cheaper than humans. And so, again, this system that led lots of people to believe that hard work and loyalty would lead to continued economic benefits is being undermined, in this case, by technology. The last example is one that I actually am very fascinated by, and that is dissolving pensions. My understanding of pensions is that employees took lower salaries so that the companies they worked for would then invest the portion of their salary that they did not take into a pension fund that would then pay them after they retired. When those pensions were dissolved, the actual employers reneged on their contract. They violated the rules of the system. And that, of course, would lead people to believe that the system doesn't work, and going forward, to question the motives of any employer. Are you just saying this so you can pay me less now and pay yourselves more later? So these are two systems that definitely get talked about a lot. The systems that I tend to focus on in my research are about income inequality and wealth inequality. There's, again, this belief that people who work harder earn more money. But given that the average CEO's salary ratio relative to the lowest paid employee of their company is 354-1, it really begs the question, do CEOs work 354 times more than janitors? I'm going to suggest that the answer to that is no, but I think you're beginning to get the point very clearly that there are lots of ways of understanding that systems can be and often are undermined. When we talk about income inequality, another way of undermining that is to think about pay gaps based on gender and based on race. In general, the average woman earns 78 cents for every man. But among law partners, female law partners actually earn 54% less on average than male law partners. So we've normalized everything. We've normalized degree, we've normalized the amount of money that gets brought in, and we're still seeing huge gender gaps. And it can't just be because women work 54 to 78% less effectively than men. That really does not make sense. So these are the kinds of systems that I focus on, and everything that I present to you today, I will be looking at income inequality and systems of income generation and how beliefs about those systems actually impact consumer behavior. So I'm going to start with a paper that is near and dear to my heart. This is probably my favorite paper. This one, the name keeps changing. It's under third round review at one of our top journals, very promising reviews, but they want even more evidence than we've already given. In this paper, we argue that system beliefs and income redistribution interact to impact how much money and how much value people place on conspicuous consumption. What we do to do this, we use surveys and we also use experiments. So this is a multi-methodological paper that economists and psychologists can both sort of get behind and say, we believe the data are valid. We examine and manipulate beliefs about whether the system does not work. So in just about every national survey, like the World Value Survey, for example, there is a question about, do you think that hard work makes a difference in people's economic outcomes? And so we use actually a survey from the Netherlands. It's called the LIS survey. So it's a panel survey that's nationally representative. We use those data to look at people's beliefs about income generation in the Netherlands and whether they think income redistribution should be lower or higher. And what we find is that When people believe the system works, so hard work generates more income, they want lower income redistribution. And those people also believe that when income redistribution is lower, that the status that people have is deserved and legitimate. Okay, so your status as an upstanding member of your community is deserved. You earned that status. Conversely, if people believe that the system does not work, so hard work does not really equate to greater levels of income generation, they want higher levels of income redistribution. And when income is redistributed at higher levels, they then begin to believe that status is deserved. So what you see on the little box over here is these, in each of these cases, low income redistribution and high income redistribution under these circumstances. So low income redistribution when the system works, high income redistribution when the system does not work, lead people to believe that the system is being reinforced. Right, the system is being supported. Status is deserved. And when status is deserved, people actually engage more in conspicuous consumption of status goods. What I mean when I say that, I'm thinking about things like Rolex watches, Tag Heuer watches, really expensive things that, you know, maybe you get as a gift from a grandparent, but you might be able to purchase them if you earn a certain amount of money. So not only are people more interested in this kind of consumption, they're willing to pay more for it. So they're willing to pay, you know, 100, 110% of the retail price of a Tag Heuer when they believe status is deserved, but they're only willing to pay about 70% when they think status is not deserved, right? So that's really meaningful because those watches can be really expensive. they also tend to have a more positive view of others that they observe consuming these conspicuous status goods. So if I see you with a Chanel bag and I think your status is deserved, then I think you're a hard worker. I think you're somebody I want to get to know. If I get to know you and I think your career sounds interesting to my children, I would introduce you to them. I'd want you to talk to them. So I really value you more as a person under the conditions that lead me to believe that status is deserved. So again, we test this using surveys, we test this using experiments, and we find over and over and over again that higher income is desired when the system does not work, higher income redistribution is desired when the system does not work, and lower income redistribution is desired when systems do work. And that leads to increased spending on conspicuous consumption. So you might be asking yourself at this point, what about these other two spaces? What about these situations where the system doesn't work, but there's low income redistribution, or the system does work, but there are actually really high levels of income redistribution? We call these non-fit conditions. These are situations that are suboptimal. And what we find is in these cases, of course, people believe that status is undeserved, and so these systems are being undermined. But what this does for consumer behavior, particularly in the economic sphere, is it leads to increased saving. These people just hold on to their money. And I found this really interesting effect that they're also have an increased interest in multitasking products. So the idea here is that they stretch their money, so they want to get more bang for their buck. So when the system is being undermined, when it's perceived as less legitimate, you see people expressing more interest in things like 5-in-1 copiers, right? So this is a multifunction device. You see people expressing more interest in food processors that also grate cheese and crush ice and make smoothies, right? So you're probably thinking about ninja bullets and things like that. And those are the actual things that we use to test this. And so you see this, you know, increased interest in things that can do lots of things. So stretching the dollar, hoarding money, holding on to it when the system is unfair. In other work, I look at how people's beliefs about whether the system works get triggered differently when they are compared to others, and how that comparison impacts the way they actually go about gathering economic resources. So this is really fun work. What I do to sort of investigate this is I measure, again, income generation systems. Do people believe that these systems work or that they don't work? And what I find is when people believe that these income generation systems work, they actually tend to view other people in economic terms. So is it good for me to form a relationship with you? Will that help me earn more money? Will that bring me in more clients? Can you introduce me to the CEO of this company that I want to consult for? Those are the kinds of things that begin to matter a lot more. When people think systems don't work, they actually tend to view each other more socially. Are you nice? Do I like you? Do you make me laugh? Right? Those things become much more important. So what happens is, what we do is we measure these beliefs about how the system works, and then we have people compare themselves with others on dimensions that have been shown to influence how much money people make. So we say, you know, how tall are you? There's evidence that taller people earn more money. We say, you know, how smart are you? There is some evidence that smarter people earn more money. We say, you know, how much like a typical representative of your gender are you? You know, those kinds of things are correlated with the amount of income people generate. What we find is when people don't believe the system works, comparing them with others just makes them celebrate diversity. They're like, hey, we're all different and we're all necessary and you guys are great. Let's go hang out. But when the system does work and you get people to compare themselves with others, they actually feel a stronger urgency to compete for economic resources. And what this looks like in the lab is lower reporting of income in order to pay lower taxes. It looks like condoning, engaging in, and encouraging people to misreport tax write-offs on their income. So, you know, maybe you donated $50 to NPR this year, but nobody will notice if you just add an extra zero, right? These are the kinds of behaviors that we see. So this is dishonesty for economic gain. And the last thing we see is dishonest reporting of performance for financial gain. So what I want you to notice is that in the first example, reporting lower income, you're basically saying, hey, I made less money. In the second one, you're saying, hey, I kept less money. But in the last one, what we actually find is people saying, hey, I performed much better, and I think you should pay me according to how I performed. And so the paradigm for this is something that I've borrowed from Dan Ariely and Nina Mazar and Isha Sharma. What we have people do is solve a bunch of math problems, and we tell them, you know, for each math problem that you get right, we'll give you an extra quarter. And for some of those people, we grade the math problems, and for the other people, we just say, okay, here's the answer key, tell us how well you did. The people who believe the system works and who did the social comparison actually report higher performance on these math problems than people who were graded. And we actually do a pretest. So we grade their other math problems of the same type. These are usually three-digit addition or three-digit multiplication problems. So it's things that you learn in middle and elementary school. They actually report doing better the second time around, even compared to how well they performed when we graded them the first time, right? So these people really are motivated to seem more competitive in economic ways. We find that they don't gamble more, so they're not more risk-seeking economically in general, and they're not more dishonest in general. So they're not, you know, going to cheat on their wives or their husbands. They're not going to, you know, just generally lie and say they're wearing a red shirt when they're wearing a blue shirt. It's really just dishonesty in the pursuit of economic resources. So we take this one step further and we say, okay, we had you compare yourselves with, you know, your average peers or people that you really don't know very well. What happens when you compare yourself with somebody that you were once the equivalent to? So what happens when you compare yourself to somebody you went to high school with or somebody that you graduated from college with, right? What happens then? Because at this point, you can see material differences in decisions that you've made over the past 10 or 15 years. So what we did is, again, we measured views about how the system works. We, you know, sort of theorized that this changes how people are viewed. And then we gave people a scenario where they ran into this person they used to work with or someone they graduated high school with, a former peer. And that peer was really happy to see them and said, hey, we just bought a house. We're having a housewarming this weekend. You should come. And so we tell the participants, you go and you see a house. And the house is either, you know, a moderate house, you know, maybe like a 5-bedroom, 2,000 square foot type of house, or the house is an 8-bedroom, 8,000 square foot house on 5 acres of land. And we say, you know, this is your friend's house. You use Google Maps and this is what you see. And then we measure their emotions around this, and we put them in subsequent tasks like the ones I just talked about, cheating on income tax, misreporting income tax, and so on. What we find is these people, when the system works and your former peer is extremely successful, these are the people who really feel that urgency to generate economic resources. These are the people who cheat. And it turns out that their cheating is motivated by jealousy, and it's motivated by shame. So they feel like they should be doing better. We used to be equals, and now you are head and shoulders greater than me. And so the shame and the jealousy actually motivate them to report lower income on their taxes, so they hoard more money. Condoning illegal tax write-offs. So yes, that was a business dinner. We talked about my job for 1 second. It counts, that kind of thing. And also, again, dishonest reporting of their performance for financial gain. We also find that these beliefs about whether the system works or does not work shape whether people are willing to help niche causes. So what I mean when I say niche causes is causes that aren't, you know, the mainstream causes or the universally sympathetic ones. So what are these causes? Religion is the biggest one. Most people who are religious give money to their religious institutions. Education is another one. A lot of people donate to education. When I think about universally sympathetic causes, the example I always give is children with cancer. Everybody gives to children with cancer. But we have these niche causes that are sort of at the fringes where people have differing beliefs about whether these are even important, right? And so the examples that I use in my work tend to be battered women, teenagers and young adults who were abused as children, but who are now, you know, over 21. So do we have an obligation to help them as a society? Yes or no? People actually differ on that belief. On the other side, when I think about niche environmental causes, I think a lot about the ASPCA, animal shelters, those kinds of things. And I also look at water cleanup projects, you know, cutting down on carbon emissions, those kinds of things. So the question that I ask in this work is, you know, is it possible to use these beliefs about whether the system works to actually predict the very fringe causes that people support? And we show that the answer is yes. Consistently, when the system does not work, people feel much more obligated to help these people at the fringes of charitable causes. So these are the battered women, these are the abused children, those kinds of people get a lot of sympathy. You see them, you know, volunteering, doing call-a-thons, donating money, and so on. On the flip side, when people think the system works, they're really not trying to help other people. The system works by definition means that whatever circumstance you find yourself in is deserved. You have made decisions that landed you there. Now, I don't know what those decisions might be, but, you know, some people say things like, you made the choice to marry somebody who abused you, right? I don't believe that personally, but I know that other people do believe that. And their system beliefs predict them holding those beliefs. But what you find is that they're much more sympathetic to animal causes, to environmental causes, particularly at the fringes. And so we find them engaging, like I described, in more effortful fundraising, but we also find them supporting tax increases that go to these niche causes. And I think that last finding is particularly important. In America, we pretty much as a country talk loudly and frequently about how much we hate paying taxes. We just elected a guy who a lot of people think hasn't paid taxes in at least 15 years, right? So this is heroic behavior, not paying taxes. But our participants are saying, no, actually, we're willing to pay more. We're willing to actually spend our hard-earned money, give it to the government so that more programs can be provided to support these niche causes. Right? And so what I've just presented to you are lots of examples about how these beliefs about whether the income generation system works impact what people do with their money and to get money as a result of being in these systems. And I find it particularly fascinating. And I think over the next 20 to 50 years, this type of research and understanding how these beliefs about whether systems work or not will become even more important. There's a lot of text on this slide, so I'm going to just read it. We are beginning to see a lot more shifts in economic behavior, and we'll begin to, over time, see more examples of people believing that the system doesn't work. So this this quote is from an article called Silicon Valley Has an Empathy Vacuum by Om Malik. It was published in The New Yorker on November 28th. Otto, a Bay Area startup that was recently acquired by Uber, wants to automate trucking and recently wrapped up a 120-mile driverless delivery of 50,000 cans of beer between Fort Collins and Colorado Springs. From a technological standpoint, it was a jaw-dropping achievement accompanied by predictions of improved highway safety. From the point of view of a truck driver with a mortgage and a kid in college, it was a devastating, oh, expletive moment. That one technological breakthrough puts nearly 2 million long-haul trucking jobs at risk, and an entire economic ecosystem could break down. So what happens to these 2 million truck drivers when they stop believing that the system they use to generate income actually works for them? I think it's really important that we get ahead of these types of trends because we have more and more technological innovations taking jobs away from people without considering the economic consequences of those actions. And so that's my work. Thank you so much. So let's talk.
Thank you. That was fascinating. I'm also having a little trouble putting a couple things together, and maybe I'm mishearing it, but it seems to me like when the system works, you're suggesting people who believe that tend to be more dishonest. That seems like a very bad conundrum. It seems like making the system work should be a good thing, but if we believe that the system works and we do more bad things, I don't understand that, and how do we get out of that?
So that's a really good question. So in that work, what we find is it's only when people feel like they're being directly compared that they're more dishonest. That's really when the importance of their economic resources becomes salient. So for example, if we ask them to, you know, go and visit their friend before we ask them whether they believe the system works, they tend not to experience as high levels of jealousy. But if they've been thinking about income generation and then they see their friends' economic and social outcomes, that makes them think they should be doing better, and that then that sort of drives the dishonest behavior that we see. And one of the sort of consequences for this is that in more competitive areas, you tend to see more unethical behavior. You tend to see a lot of cheating in really competitive universities, for example. A few years ago, there was a really large cheating scandal at Harvard. You tend to see more anxiety about performing and doing things that are in spirit designed to enhance performance, but not that don't necessarily work that way. Like you see people taking their friend's ADHD medication, anything to sort of get an advantage. And so you do see more dishonesty, and that is disheartening, but it's not always the case that you see more dishonesty.
So you brought up the name of our president-elect. And I'm wondering if you could just provide a little commentary on why voters who chose Mr. Trump, a billionaire who has a reputation for being dishonest, relates to those voters as people having beliefs that the system doesn't work. You have any insights for us along those lines?
So let me just make sure I understand your question. You're asking why voters who believe the system doesn't work actually chose somebody who comes across as dishonest on a consistent basis, why they would support someone like that. I think that's a really fascinating question. I don't actually have a concrete example or even really a full explanation for it. But I do think that in some meaningful ways, people think that because he has been so dishonest and he hasn't been found guilty in a lot of these cases, that it's not really that he's dishonest, it's that he's smart, right? He's found a way to sort of game the system. And that makes him a role model, right? So people who can be successful even in systems that don't work are, in general, admired, seen as heroes. So that's sort of that's one sort of take on it. I also think, though, that the systems that a lot of people who voted for him support or sort of think don't work are systems that they felt left out of. So if we think, for example, about economic recovery in towns where manufacturing jobs have been removed, these people really haven't been in the political conversation in a long time. We talk a lot in this country about the middle class, the middle class, the middle class, but these people aren't in the middle class anymore. And so by not having a seat at the table, there is a lot of space to suggest that they would support somebody who acknowledged their existence on a consistent basis. So it's not really about his dishonesty necessarily. It might also be about being visible.
It seems to me that a majority of the people start life thinking systems work for them. So at some point, they figure out the system doesn't work for a certain percentage of people. What other values change at that time?
Ooh, so the question is, what other values change as people begin to believe that systems don't work for them? Okay, so this is about the emotions in transition from believing the system works to believing it doesn't. So one of the things that we see in the literature is that empathy for others increases as beliefs that the system works decrease. And so you see, for example, a lot more attention to the others around you. You see more empathy, you see more sort of community building types of behaviors. There's some research in psychology and in marketing that suggests that you become more open to expressions of anger as your belief that the system works sort of decreases, right? So there's research that shows that people who believe the system is fair and just don't get angry when they hear about innocent victims. So they don't get angry when they hear about casualties of war. They don't get angry when they hear about rape victims, for example. But as that belief in the fairness of the system sort of wanes, the buffer against anger goes away, and people begin to express openly these ideas that there's a problem here, right? And so even talking about that and feeling the anger around that is a shift. In my work, though, I deal less with the sort of continuum of emotions around that, and I tend to look at more trends and correlations. And I don't do any sort of longitudinal work following the same person and looking at their beliefs shift. Although there are some data sets that provide that information, I think it's a really cool question to answer.
Thank you. Very interesting presentation. I love the way you're connecting the social psychology with, you know, what motivates behavior. And I'm wondering if we could ask you to speculate a bit about some of our local community issues that we're working to address. You may be aware that we're ranked highly in terms of concentrated poverty in the center of the city. And one system, I think in your terms, that many of us have invested in is the education system. We've invested in a Say Yes to Education and many other components included in a pipeline that is meant to sort of bring inner city youth into opportunities, perhaps similar to what you shared your mother aspired to in terms of positive outcomes. So that's the goal. And yet I'm thinking as you're describing these systems that perhaps in many of these neighborhoods, there's ample reason for the population to believe that this system, the education system, doesn't work. And so I'm wondering if your research might have implications for how to help make the system useful to groups who don't see it as perhaps functioning.
Okay, that is a really great question. All right, so if I understand you correctly, the question is about how the education system, for example, in Syracuse, which we know has a high concentration of poverty, there are lots of investments in that system, including Say Yes and other pipeline programs for students. But there's, you know, sort of a difference in belief about whether those programs work or whether those programs will actually give people opportunities or just bring them heartache, whether they can even be successful under those circumstances. I think it's really important when you are trying to convince people to take advantage of these kinds of opportunities that you show them the long run effects of these programs. And so it's not just about we can get you to college. It's about, you know, here's why college is important. You know, here's what this can do for you. Here are other resources to sort of help you along the way. And so there has to be some marketing, essentially, to the target group. You have to convince the students and the teachers to buy in to the belief that these opportunities will be successful for them and will lead to them having better outcomes. I think one of the things I noticed in Syracuse is that a lot of the inner city students don't necessarily know a lot of people who've gone to college and had these kinds of outcomes. And so one thing that might be helpful is showing them people who were similar to them at an earlier point in their lives and how programs like this or taking advantage of opportunities provided helped them. And so you almost need the testimonial from the really credible witnesses to encourage people to think that these will actually result in them living a different life than the one they're being raised in. But it is effortful. And there are lots of turns where people can begin to lose their faith in economic systems. I know for me personally, hearing race-based statistics about performing on the SATs was really disheartening. Students of color tend to perform less well on standardized tests in general. But when I think about the idea that colleges use these tests, maybe even more than they use my GPA, then that, you know, that creates some anxiety that makes that sort of pushes back on my belief that this would work for me. Right. And so it's also, I think, going to require more vigilance about when people's belief in the system might start to wax and wane.
I'm having a little problem connecting the dots with the slide that showed the people who are most likely to cheat. And what I was thinking about when I was looking at that is that people across the country on the lowest end of the economic spectrum give the most philanthropically compared to middle class and upper middle class, high income. If you're going to be in that lower income category, I'm guessing it may be more likely you are not convinced that the system works. So it seems like the people on the upper income levels have the resources to invest their money in offshore accounts and to hire tax accountants that can manage their money in a way that may not be quite as upright as other people in filing their income tax. And I also didn't get whether the math game, is that what ends up being translated to cheating on your tax? I lost something there. Sorry about that. If you could just explain that.
No problem. So let me explain the dependent variables in those studies first, and then we can go back to the question about giving differences between socioeconomic groups. So we actually did a number of surveys to find the cheating attitudes on taxes. So what we did, and there were surveys that were sort of manipulated as experiments. So we asked people for their beliefs of whether the system worked. So these are scales. Belief in a just world is one. System justice is another. So we asked them for their beliefs. And then we either have them compare themselves with their peers. How tall are you? You know, how much taller or shorter? How much smarter or, you know, less smart, et cetera, are you? And then we say, we have them take a test, a sort of survey that talks about risky behaviors in general. So it talks about things like gambling, like cheating on a spouse, but it also talks about things like misreporting your income, saying things are tax write-offs when they're not, and those kinds of things. It's the domain-specific risk-seeking scale. And so what we find is that when people compare themselves to others before taking that scale and they believe the system works, they express more support of cheating on taxes. When they don't compare themselves with others until after they fill out that scale, they express fewer cheating attitudes.
So that's that. Now, the math questions, what we do is we tell some people, you'll get an extra 25 cents for each problem that you solve correctly. In some cases, it's math questions. In some cases, it's really tedious counting type tasks. And in other cases, it's puzzles. It's solving these army puzzles, these spatial reasoning puzzles. But we tell them for anything that you do successfully, you'll earn an amount of money. So it's performance-based pay. And then in some cases, we have them accurately, or we grade their work, and so we look at the accuracy of it. And in other cases, we have them grade their own work. When they grade their own work and they believe the system works and they've just compared themselves with others, they cheat more. They misreport more. So they'll say they got 10 of these puzzles correct when really the average is 8, and on the first round they only got 8 correct. So that performance difference is actually significant, and it translates into earning more money for the task. So they misreport their performance to get more money.
Can I just ask, is the information they report, is it known to the entire group or is it private?
It's private.
Oh, it is. Okay.
It's private information, yes. It's not known to the entire group. We sort of use the paradigm that in general in this country, people don't discuss their income. There's a taboo around it, and some people are led to believe that it's actually illegal to tell your coworkers how much money you've made. And so we sort of leverage that norm in this country for the study itself. Does that help clarify? You're welcome. I'm sorry for everybody who had that question. So let's talk about the philanthropy now. So the point was raised that people at the lower ends tend to give proportionately more money to charity, right, than people at the higher ends of the spectrum. That is definitely true. What's less true is whether because people earn less money, they actually think the system is unjust. There's actually a large body of evidence to suggest that income itself is not indicative of beliefs about whether the system works. Some people legitimately think they deserve less money. They think, you know, oh, I'm just working part-time, or oh, I'm just doing this little job. I don't deserve to earn $50,000 a year for that. And so what we do is we look at their beliefs and we control for income. And we find that this effect of giving to these very niche causes is sustained even when you account for the income that people make. And so income doesn't drive support for these niche causes. We actually argue in that work that these system beliefs lead people to use heuristics to evaluate the morality of other causes, and that the heuristics that they develop are different based on their system beliefs. And so that's really what's underlying their helping behavior. It's less about income and more about just how do you believe deservingness works? Is it the people who have agency who could do better, maybe, do they deserve help? Or is it these helpless creatures in the environment that tend to be acted upon that deserve more help?
Hi. I have to ask this question. It's two questions. The first one's really short, but I have to ask, what happened to your mom?
Oh, I'm really glad you asked that. So my mom passed away my freshman year of college. The breast cancer came back twice. She did chemo and radiation. She had a double mastectomy. But by the time I was a freshman in college, we kind of knew that the end was coming. So she ultimately passed away on Valentine's Day, which was the first day of the second week of classes, my second semester of freshman year. So I went home for the funeral and to see my family. But as you might suspect, there was a clause in my mother's will that if I did not return to school within a week, that my inheritance would be given to the American Cancer Association. So yeah, and that, you know, really stems from a hesitance to believe that universities would be sympathetic to somebody, you know, just taking a semester off to deal with loss. And so I was fortunate to go to a university with a lot of counseling resources and a lot of support. And so that really helped. But that's how the story sort of ends.
Well, it sounds like you had her longer than you might have.
Yes. She actually lived about a year longer than the doctors predicted she would. That was awesome.
Well, the other question, I guess, has to do with agency, I guess, because we talk about trusting the system. The system works or not, which doesn't seem to really, you're not really tying it to whether the system really works or not, but whether people feel it works or not. And it seems to me you could have two reactions to that on either way. Either way, if you think it works, you could be complacent. If you think it doesn't work, you could be apathetic. I mean, or angry, or nihilistic. And I think there was a lot of that going on in the campaign. But you could also, if you think the system doesn't work and you believe that you have agency, then that seems to be the formula for activism and for acting to improve the system. Whereas if you feel the system works, then you seem to get into this other aspect of cheating and trying to get a competitive advantage. So I ask you about that, and also whether there is a one side or the other which is more socially valuable or useful. If you believe it works and are complacent about it, or if you don't believe it works and want to make it better.
I love that question. That question, the full answer to it is sort of a life goal for my research. I think that what you're asking is, you know, are these two sort of solutions that I talk about in each study, are they really the only responses that people can have? And so you hinted at agency. You mentioned agency, and I think I mentioned that a little bit earlier. I think there is a difference between people who feel obligated to improve the system, so these are your activists, and people who think, you know, the system is going to implode, I'm going to run away, or I'm going to, you know, hoard my resources and, you know, maybe move to Canada. There's a difference there, right? And I don't actually get into that yet in my research, but I am particularly curious about when people dedicate their economic resources to advocating for others, to giving others agency, and when they don't. I honestly don't have an answer to it, but I agree with you. There are different kinds of responses. And I do think that there's a certain amount of complacency when people think the system works. And that's kind of the fear undergirding this society's resistance to increasing the social safety net. So, you know, what happens if we, you know, give people more money and welfare or let them buy steak? They're just going to be complacent because now the system is working for them and they're not motivated to work. And so we don't want to do that, right? I see that. I don't necessarily buy that argument, but I definitely see that people have it and they use it to determine their political behavior, and the candidates that they, you know, donate to financially are the ones who sort of agree with them that we don't want to encourage complacency. Other people feel like everybody should just be able to figure it out. You're smart, figure it out. And if you don't, oh well, you live in abject poverty. But what I like to push back on when people bring that up is this idea that capitalism does require a sort of hierarchy of social class or socioeconomic class, but that doesn't mean that the lowest level has to be abject poverty. There are other capitalist societies where the people who earn the least amount of money aren't actually trying to figure out how they're going to make ends meet. They have a higher quality of life, and as their quality of life improves, everybody's quality of life improves. So I think on some level, it's important to figure out what kinds of motivations underlie that kind of thinking versus what kinds of motivations get people to be a lot more complacent about helping others, about figuring out ways to make the system work better for everybody and things like that. I think it's a really big question, especially given that this is a capitalist society and we do require sort of a pyramid of tiers of income for the society itself to run. So I think it's a big question. And if you have any ideas about how to test that, if you have some data set suggestions, I am very open.
I'm wondering if you could reflect on how religious values play into the kind of constructs that you're talking about. I understand that there's a wide spectrum of religious values, but certainly people's commitment to particular values of charity and justice and so forth, does that figure in at all to your considerations?
So if I understand correctly, the question is about whether people's religious values really come to bear on, you know, their willingness to be charitable or their willingness to seek justice for others. Is that the idea? So I think I'm going to disappoint you a bit. In all of the nationally representative data that I've seen, when we add religion into our regressions, it tends to have no effect. And we look at religion in various ways. So we'll ask, do you attend church regularly or some sort of religious worship regularly? Do you try to espouse the values of your religion in everyday life on a consistent basis? Those kinds of things don't seem to matter toward people's charitable behaviors. It's a bit disappointing when I see that, but the curiosity around it has led me to look a bit more into how people think about religion. And it turns out that just because people worship the same God, that there's no real homogeneity in terms of what that means. I'm Christian, and we, in the news, when you talk about Christians, you hear a lot about evangelical Christians and prosperity theology, but I wasn't raised in either of those churches, right? And so that in and of itself is evidence enough for me that there's more heterogeneity that's not really captured by how we measure people's religiosity and their religious beliefs. I think if I had any sort of gripe or complaint is that we don't do a great job of measuring people's obligation to help others or their sort of obligation to take care of their communities and that sort of thing in our religion measures. But that tends to be what we think religion should encapsulate. And so we have to do a better job of measuring what we think is important as scientists, as economists, as psychologists, et cetera.
Please join me in thanking Bragan again for a wonderfully interesting presentation today. Happy holidays, everyone.
Happy holidays. Thank you all so much. I really appreciate your questions and your attention. Drive safely in the snow.